Tuesday, September 25th, 2007, from Rochester, New York, and the Bright Memorial Library. This is the 30th anniversary of Book Sandwiched In, a book review program sponsored by the Friends of the Bright Memorial Library. Today's book is Roots by Alex Haley, who won a special award and citation for it from the Pulitzer Board in 1977. Our reviewer is Town of Brighton Justice, the Honorable Karen Morris.
We're very fortunate to have Karen Morris here to help us celebrate the 30th anniversary of Book Sandwiched In with the review of the 1977 bestseller, Roots. Can you believe it was written 30 years ago? We gave Karen a list of the bestsellers of 1977, and she selected Roots, which I think will be a very exciting choice. Judge Morris has been Brighton Town Justice since 1994. She is also a professor at Monroe Community College and the author of instructional software, You Be the Judge, and Hotel, Restaurant, and Travel Law. In addition to belonging to many professional and community organizations, Judge Morris is a big sister in the Brighton Kiwanis Big Brother program and is a Girl Scout leader in the inner city. This summer, she completed a triathlon consisting of running, biking, and swimming. I didn't ask her when she came in. She's also very busy putting the finishing touches on a book titled Lessons in Law and Life from Harry Potter's Adventure. Should be interesting, huh? It is my pleasure to present Brighton Town Justice Karen Morris.
Good evening, all. How nice it is to be with you. Thank you. I'm very honored to be your guest speaker for your 30th anniversary. Congratulations on those 30 years of doing great service to the town of Brighton. And I must extend a special congratulations to Loretta Clodo, your new president, who is or was my colleague at MCC until she retired as a professor in nursing. So 30 years ago was Roots. I have up here the book. You're welcome to come and take a look after. Also, the audio tape. I do much of my reading on audio tape these days. We all spend time in the car. It's a great way to fit in reading time when there's not a lot of other way to recapture time to read. And often now, unlike several years ago when I started doing audio tapes, now there's always usually an outstanding reader, somebody who is an actor and has much to offer to enhance the story as you listen to it. So I encourage everybody to think about audio reading. It was interesting picking a book. You were nice enough to give me the choice of any book on the bestseller list 30 years ago. Let me tell you what was among the choices. Amityville Horror was one of them. The sequel to The Love Story. Remember that? The Love Story was so big. And then there was the sequel, which was a distant second. Thornbirds, which was quite popular with issues that remain relevant to today. And then there was Roots. And to me, Roots was, there wasn't a question. Roots was definitely going to be the choice. It profoundly portrays uncomfortably an unproud time in our history. And I think it's very important to re-examine that time in our history. It's because we then remember, by reacquainting with the cruelty of the time, we fortify our commitment to guard against the reappearance of any forces that could lead us again down the path of inhumanity and stamp out injustice. And so to remind ourselves, revisiting these books is a very worthwhile undertaking. A reason why this choice was compelling is that my view of slavery was shaped by the miniseries on TV of Roots. I can remember I get teary-eyed. I can remember vividly the scene where Kizzy is taken, I'm going to get teary-eyed, from Kunta and Belle. And Belle is on the porch of her hut, and she sees the cart with Kizzy in chains. And the cart is being driven away with a horse and buggy, and the horror on the face of Belle, Kizzy's mother, and Kunta's wife, and then Kizzy. So Kunta was married to Belle. They had this daughter, Kizzy. Kizzy was taken away to be sold. And the horror on the mother and father's face that you see in that movie just is chilling and doesn't go away. I can still see the mother chasing after that cart with the chained Kizzy, who at the time was a young teenage girl. The book and the miniseries, that TV miniseries, were extremely successful. The book won the Pulitzer Prize. The miniseries was nominated for 37 Emmy Awards. It won 9 of those. It won the Golden Globe and Peabody Awards. It was unprecedented in the Nielsen ratings and remains today the last of the series. That last show of the series is the third highest rated U.S. programs, television programs ever. Can you guess what the first and second are? Say it again. Super Bowl is not it. But a good guess, probably a close fourth. Dallas is correct. The resolution of who shot JR on Dallas, that was second. The first. No. No. Yes. The final show of MASH. So the miniseries was a new concept in its time to have consecutive nights shows. Until that time, the miniseries were all done with weekly installments. This was done with 7 or 8 consecutive nights. The reason for this was that the executives of ABC, which was this network that showed the show, thought that it was not going to be a success, particularly because there were black heroes and white villains. And so the executives wanted to get the show over with. They committed to do it, but wanted to get it on and off before the sweep ratings came out. So that was what prompted them to have the consecutive nights. In the ads for the series, they featured white actors disproportionately to the show. And then this is really interesting, which goes towards the issue of compromises that were made for angst about what the feelings were about slavery then and now. For the first episode, the writers created what was not in the book, a conscious stricken slave captain. So that clearly was nowhere in the history books. So the sort of whitewashing the story a bit, attempting to alleviate some of the discomfort that white viewers would have over their ancestors' role in slavery. 85% of all homes saw all or part of the miniseries. Phenomenal, 85%. Some of the actors who played in it, you'll recall, Ben Vereen played the role of Chicken George, who was the child of Kizzy. Leslie Uggams played Kizzy. Kunta Kinte was played by LeVar Burton of Star Trek fame. So those of you who know Star Trek, it was Lieutenant Geordi LaForge. So he got his start in this miniseries. When reviewing a book, there's always a issue about how much do you tell. You don't, as the reviewer, want to ruin the story for the potential readers in your audience. This book is a little different since it's been with us for 30 years. I assume that virtually all of you who have any interest in it have already read it or seen the movie. So I'm not going to be shy about giving away parts of the story. It is, of course, not an easy read. There is just so much pain inflicted on human beings, and it's such an unproud time in our history. We initially are introduced to this young boy, Kunta Kinte, who is from Gambia in Africa, and if you look on the map in the upper left, which would be west, northwest, you'll see Gambia River and the area of Gambia, which is surrounded by the Sudan. That's where he was from. And Alex Haley is so clever in leading us to be so attached to this character and to respect the character that he is, so that we develop a close relationship. He's an alert, a curious boy. He has a lot of response. He's a responsible boy. He believes strongly in the principles of his tribe. He relates strongly to his identity as a member of the Mandinka tribe in this village of Juferde, which is in Gambia. But we sort of know there's this cloud over him, and as we get to know him, there's a tenseness as the reader because you have an idea of what is coming. He's very into his religion, Allah. He prays to Allah. We learn about a practice of his tribe. At age 15, the boys of the tribe are taken from their home for a three-month period. It's called coming of manhood. And they learn to hunt. They learn to defend in a fight. Not to fight, but to defend in a fight, because they are not an aggressive tribe. They're circumcised as part of the process of becoming a man. And they are told as part of that training not to be alone in an isolated area, because the village knows about the taking of slaves from the slave traders coming to Africa and capturing these black young teens and taking them to be sold as slaves. Alas, he was captured. And the next part of the book is so hard to read. The torture during the passage, during the boat trip from Africa to this country. There were many slaves on the boat, chained together. They're in the bowels of the boat. There's no bathroom facilities, meager food. People are dying along the way. They don't know where they're headed. Kunta Kinte prays to Allah and can't understand why Allah is allowing this to happen. They arrive in Annapolis, Maryland in September of 1967. He is sold. He can't believe that this is happening. The audacity that somebody could think that these African men are somebody's, could be somebody's property. So he doesn't immediately concede to the concept of slavery and, of course, pays a price. There's the whipping and the chaining, and ultimately his part of his foot was cut off. No operation, no anesthesia, no medicine to alleviate the pain. Just a terrible time. Ultimately, he recognizes he needs to do what he can do in order to stay well, and always looks forward to a time when he can escape. And of course, you have these strangers from Africa. They have no idea where they are in this country, or even as he was thinking about running away, what direction to go in. And he didn't speak the language. He didn't speak English. He spoke his own language. So clearly a horrible circumstance. He decides he needs to comply, and he becomes more subservient, though always in his mind preserving his pride in who he is and his African background and his Muslim religion. He is, because of those traits, he is successful in his slave position and elevates his position on the plantation. He ultimately marries, gives birth to this child, Kizzy, who he loves and adores and sees as the way for him to carry on in this foreign world his African roots, his Mandingo tribe traditions. And he teaches her and trains her and teaches her his some words from his language and all about what his tribe was like in Africa. And then we have the incident with Kizzy. She was taught to write. Her mother could write, taught her to write. She became friendly with another slave on the plantation. That slave decided to run away. Slaves sometimes, well, when a slave ran away, they could be stopped at any time by bounty hunters, by police, by any person who was white and asked about their whereabouts and would be returned to their slave owner if they didn't have a good excuse. One circumstance that would prevent them being returned to their slave owner was a letter purportedly from their owner saying that they had a right to be out and that they had a mission to fulfill. So Kunta Kinte's daughter, Kizzy, wrote such a note for her friend, young friend, the slave who sought to run away. Impossible to be successful running away. The odds were, and the forces against you were impossible. He was caught. He was tortured. He informed where he got the note. And that's what caused the slave owner to say, look, you violate my rules, I'm selling you. You're out of here. And that was that sale of Kizzy and that horrible scene where she separated from her parents. We then see as she goes to her new master, she's sold, goes to a new master. Within 24 hours of arriving, she's raped and ultimately has a child from the master. That's Chicken George. The rest of the story I'm going to assume that you're familiar with. Hopefully I have given you a taste of what the storyline is about. I want to talk a little about Alex Haley. Alex Haley, the author, was born in 1921. He spent 20 years of service with the Coast Guard beginning in 1939. He was in the Pacific Theater of Operations during World War II and then became a journalist in the military, so he always had an inkling towards writing. When he came out of the military, he connected up with Playboy magazine, and you may remember a while back people said, oh, I bought it for the interviews. Well, those interviews were quite something. They were all written by Alex Haley, and the interviewees were a list of who's who of the times. So there was jazz legend Miles Davis, Dr. Martin Luther King, American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell, who, by the way, agreed to be interviewed only upon verification that Alex Haley was not Jewish. It's sort of ironic. Cassius Clay, who was in the process of becoming Muhammad Ali at the time of the interview, Jack Ruby's defense attorney, Melvin Belli, Sammy Davis Jr., Johnny Carson, Quincy Jones, Malcolm X, and his Playboy interview with Malcolm X led to a collaboration with Malcolm X on Malcolm X's autobiography. And interesting, in 1993, the U.S. Coast Guard, from which he retired, honored him by naming a cutter, a ship, the Alex Haley. A very sad afternote about this book is that Alex Haley was sued for copyright infringements. relating to 81 passages of the book that were in issue. Copyright, of course, is the exclusive right that an author has to creative work that the author creates, whether it's a poem or a novel or an essay. So the author was Harold Corlander, who wrote a book called The African. The case went forward, and ultimately Alex Haley settled for $650,000, which suggests, and the facts suggest, that there was some use of that prior work in Alex Haley's work. But nonetheless, he was allowed to keep all the awards, and all of the accolades continued, and the money continued. And rightly so. This book is so compelling. It's such a shame that he didn't just collaborate. Alex Haley contacted this Harold Corlander. If there were pieces of Corlander's book that he wanted, they probably could have collaborated in obviously what became an epic book of our time. The lessons from the book are many. The reminder of the horrors of slavery, the brutal whippings, the rapes, the forced separation of families, the selling of human beings. Important that we remind ourselves of those horrors so that we are sensitive to forces around us to ensure that nothing like this happens again. And also that we are sensitive to victims of slavery and understanding of what of parts of the makeup of the history of people who are African American and how that may affect them to this day. Per one author, and that was Michael Eric Dyson, the book helped convince the nation that the black story is the American story. It prodded white America to reject racial amnesia. We can't brush it under the rug. We are responsible for our history and need to make sure that we are vigilant to ensure that even the remnants of the discrimination and the hatred does not manifest itself today, and if it does, that we take action to stop it. And we have made great strides as a society. There still are after effects. There still is, unfortunately, in our society, discrimination. We see in the news in the last couple of days the Jenna 6, where we had a school that was in practice segregated, areas of the schoolyard for blacks, areas for whites. The noose comes out when somebody dares to violate that practice of separation of the races. The perception, if not the reality, is of different applications of the law. And clearly, again, our unproud history is that there was unequal application of the law. Minorities did not get the same treatment in courts as in other institutions in our society. Prosecutors and judges must redouble their efforts to ensure that the law is applied equally to all, and that there is a sensitivity to not just the reality, but also the perceptions of what transpires in court. Affirmative action. We had a major case in this country a couple of years ago where affirmative action was at risk by a very close vote in the case of Gratz versus Bollinger, which involved the University of Michigan. By a vote of 5-4, our United States Supreme Court preserved affirmative action and said still we need to make up for that prior history where the discrimination was so prevalent and so damaging. We see comedians and talk show hosts, when angered, spew racial epithets. And then they apologize and they seek treatment and they seek counseling. But again, it's that underlying discrimination that remains that we have to be intolerant of. In today's newspaper, there was information on the business page involving Tavern on the Green. Tavern on the Green is the second highest grossing restaurant in the country. Wonderful restaurant if you've been there. It's, in Central Park. It's right on the edge of Central Park. Very fun, lovely restaurant with a very comfortable ambiance. The restaurant was in the paper because there is a discrimination action that has just been begun against the restaurant based on race discrimination against employees. The restaurant denies it. However, for the case to have gotten this far, there are some prerequisites before a plaintiff can bring a discrimination case in court. For the case to have gotten this far suggests that there may be some basis to the claim. Our law has sought to make amends, and it does it in some very powerful ways. We have hate crimes. 45 states have defined certain crimes as hate crimes, crimes that carry a higher penalty if the motivation for their commission is discrimination based on race or color or religion, in our state, sexual preference, disability, gender. Also, this is interesting. In virtually every case, with one or two exceptions, if you bring a lawsuit and you are successful in that lawsuit against the defendant, you pay for your own attorney's fees. Defendant does not pay for your attorney's fees. So win or lose, each party is responsible for their own attorney's fees. One of the very few exceptions is a discrimination case. Our law has said we do not want anybody who feels discriminated against to be deterred from suing because of the money for an attorney's fee. So in that rare circumstance where you've been discriminated, you're successful in that case, your attorney's fees will be reimbursed by the defendant. There was a history involving jury selection. It was when a jury is selected, many of you have been on juries, been through jury selection, you know that each lawyer can remove certain people from the jury. You can remove unlimited numbers for cause where there's some reason why the potential juror cannot sit objectively on the case. There's also a number of people that each lawyer can remove for no reason. Well, it was believed that prosecutors were removing, when the defendant was of color, jurors of color. Now there's a law that requires before a prosecutor can remove somebody of color, the prosecutor must give a reason for removing that juror. It has to be a reason other than race. Anybody who's not of color, for whom the lawyers are removing not for cause, but we call this peremptory challenge, for no reason. You don't have to give a reason. But we want to make sure that there's no removal of people of color just because they are of color, with some belief that they might be more apt to be sympathetic to a defendant's case of color, the case of a defendant of color. So there has to be reason to remove that juror. There's also a jury diversification project that the Monroe County Bar Association is now involved in, where there is an effort to increase the number of minorities in jury pools. Many defendants of color feel that they don't get a fair trial because there are very few people of color on the jury pools. So there is now an effort to reach out. It's sort of a repeat of an effort that was done a couple of years ago to encourage people of color to come forward and volunteer themselves for jury duty. So our law is working hard to try and remove any remnants of discrimination from the legal system. Hopefully, as you read the book, we should all feel that same responsibility, be intolerant of injustice, and help make this country an even better place to live. A few final outgrowths from this book. Jeufordi, in Gambia, where Kunta Kinte was from, is a travel destination. So many people plan trips, and they couple it with a visit to a nearby island called James Island, where Africans who were captured were herded onto the ships for that grim journey across the Atlantic. Another outgrowth is that this book has revived an interest in genealogy. How was it that Alex Haley, 9 generations later, was able to go back and piece together his history? Well, fortunately tonight, for the ending to the presentation tonight, I am going to introduce a genealogist to you who's going to tell you a little bit about the genealogical aspects of the book. So this is Neil Frankel. His wife happens to be Sandy Frankel, our town supervisor. He is a Xerox engineer who recently retired and has transformed into a historian and a genealogist. So he's going to talk for maybe 10 minutes about the genealogical aspects of this book. Neil.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I was there, Sandy. It was very interesting for me to listen to Karen talking about Roots. To me, Roots is a book about a very successful genealogical investigation. So, and that's basically, kind of the skeleton of the book. And as Karen indicated, there are a lot of messages that come out of the book as well. So I want to talk a little bit about the genealogical aspects of it. For those of us who are descended from an ancestor that was an immigrant, that came over as an immigrant rather than as a slave, when we conduct a genealogical investigation, it's pretty well defined what we've got to do. And I don't mean to say it's always easy, but it's well defined. That we can go to the Ellis Island database, we can go to the census data, we can look for naturalization records, there are just so many databases that we can tap into to try to track back our families and get some information about our ancestors. But for African Americans, it's a whole different story. Ellis Island is of no value whatsoever. Then the database there is of no value whatsoever. As far as census records are concerned, basically the Civil War is the barrier. It's very difficult for an African American to go back before the Civil War in terms of a genealogical search. After the Civil War, the slaves were freed. And in the first census after the Civil War was in 1870. So the 1870 census starts giving useful information in an African American's genealogical search. And after the Civil War, you start getting records. They have names now. Before the Civil War, they had first names only. But African Americans, when they were slaves, were considered property. And they did appear in property records of property. However, even their first names were not usually listed. Usually they were listed as by gender and age. The number of slaves in a given holding of property, a given plantation, the number of slaves based on how many female slaves of a certain age, how many male slaves of a certain age, and that's it. So you can imagine, and there were no marriage records, There are no deeds because they didn't own anything. There are just no records whatsoever to look at. So it's very frustrating for an African American who wants to go back to the pre 1870 or 1865 period to do a genealogical search. So what Alex Haley has done here is just amazing. It's remarkable what he did. And one of the reasons he was able, so he went back all the way back to his slave ancestor, the male slave ancestor, who left the Gambia in 1767 is when he was put on a ship at the Gambia River. He was put on a ship and a few months later arrived in Annapolis, Maryland, as Karen indicated. And Alex Haley wrote Roots. Actually, it was first published in 1976. It became a bestseller very shortly thereafter. So it's more than 200 years passed, and yet Alex Haley, a very crucial aid to his genealogical investigation, were words that Kunta Kinte had told to Kizzy and said, I want you to remember these African words, and I want you to remember these African stories, and I want you to tell your children the same thing, and I want you to tell them to tell their children the same thing. This man was a very strong, Kunta Kinte had a very strong character. His name, I believe, was Terry. His assigned slave name was Terry. Toby, thank you. His assigned slave name was Toby, but when other slaves, when white men or white people were not in the vicinity, and if another slave called him Toby, he would turn at them, he would scowl at them, and he would say, I'm Kunta Kinte, I'm not Toby. And so he was a man of very strong character. And somehow for over 200 years in that family, in that line of his children and their children and their children, somehow they kept the oral history of their family, the African oral history, they kept it alive. And that enabled Alex Haley, those were clues that enabled him to trace his ancestry all the way back to the, you know, to the Gambia River, the Mandingo tribe, and all the rest. Some of the words were like Kambi Balongo. They had no idea what it meant, but they just told their kids, well, Kambi Balongo, right? Well, it means Gambia River. And he said, and we also in Africa, he said, we have a stringed instrument called the ko. And that was the very similar instrument that the Mandingo tribe uses. They have a stringed instrument. And same thing. They had no idea what it was. You know, they just kept telling the next generation, remember this, right? So that was really significant. However, this method that Alex Haley used to conduct a genealogical investigation has not been, as far as I know, it's not been repeated. And it's not become the model for African American genealogical searches. And you can imagine why. How many families have an oral history that has survived for 200 years, especially slave family, formerly, you know, families descended from slaves, where the family was broken up with regularity at the whim of the owners. They would sell off the children, they would sell off the spouse. So the families were constantly being broken up, and they were sent down. When cotton became really big down in the Deep South, a lot of the slaves from places like Maryland were then sold down to the Deep South because they needed more labor, more help with the cotton down there. So that's the sad story, is that very few families can actually do that, what Alex Haley did. But the good news is there are new ways of conducting searches for African Americans. And to summarize, these are databases, digital databases, new databases that have been developed that thanks to the Mormons have been very busy transcribing handwritten records, photocopies. They're responsible for the Ellis Island website. Many of you probably know about that. They've been very busy, and they're still doing the same sort of thing. More about that in a moment. Another thing that has changed is DNA analysis, which was not really there for Alex Haley, but it would have helped him a lot, probably. And I'll say a little bit about that as well. And these modern methods have been popularized by Henry Louis Gates Jr. of Harvard University recently, and PBS. Some of you may have seen a program on PBS about tracing Oprah Winfrey's roots. A very fascinating story. And in fact, they have also traced Whoopi Goldberg and a whole number of. I actually have a DVD here of the full series that they did. But they actually did. Let's see, who did they do? They did Whoopi Goldberg, Bishop T-Day Jakes, astronaut Mae Jemison, musician, producer Quincy Jones, sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, comedian actor Chris Tucker, and TV pioneer philanthropist Oprah Winfrey. And Henry Louis Gates himself, they did him too. That has popularized these new methods. I'll tell you a little bit about them. The digital databases. Well, of course, first there's the census records, and the Mormons once again have helped us with that. And for African Americans, they can use the 1870 census, and all the ones following that. The earlier ones they do not even show up. There's another one which is very, very new. I call it the British Colonies Slave Database. And this is for the year 1934, when the UK abolished slavery, and they started collecting massive amounts of data on the slaves. So this was 1834. This is before the Civil War. You know, this was when they were still slaves, basically. You know, for 1834, they have put online in Barbados the 100,000 slave records from Barbados alone, and when they complete the other British colonies, they will have a database that consists of 3 million slave records. And this does include their names, their owners, and ages, and genders, and all kinds of data about these slaves. So the Mormons are busily finishing the job, and by January of 2008, they should have that work done. So for any people who had their ancestry through, let's say, the Caribbean Islands and such, that should be very helpful for them. There's also another database, the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database at the Du Bois Institute at Harvard, where they have assembled data on 27,000 of the transatlantic slave trading voyages from 1650 to 1867. And they figure that they have accounted for two-thirds of all the slave trading voyages that ever sailed from Africa. And so far, that database is very useful for scholars, but it's very hard to use. And they're working on a much friendlier interface for the rest of us. Other databases can be found on Cindy's List, which is a very popular genealogical website, and also Christine's genealogy website. I have some of my cards here, which has my website on it. And I have all the references. Any of the references, if you're interested in, you can take one of my cards, go to my website, and you'll find all these references. Now, I want to say a little bit about the DNA analysis, because it's really exciting what they can do with DNA analysis. There are three kinds of DNA analyses that they do. They can trace your male line, your male ancestral line. They can trace your female ancestral line. or they can do what's called an admixture test. Look at key markers in your DNA and compare that with corresponding markers from data that they have on different tribes around the world, different peoples around the world, and from Europe and Asia as well, not just from Africa. And here I want to just show you an example of what is a, let's see here if I can move the cursor. Let's try that. Okay. So you don't have to read the actual names on there. I don't think you can. But basically what I'm showing there is a family tree. And it happens to be the family tree of a woman named Beth Nolan, who is from Australia. And she published it on the web. Anything you publish on the web, anybody might use it for anything. You have to be careful. But anyway, I think she meant for us to see her family tree. She did a wonderful job. What I show there, where it says the male line, so that would be her father, her paternal grandfather, and her paternal great-grandfather. So I call that one great. She got as far as one great on the male line, right? And then if you look down below, I have the female line indicated. And there, she got four greats. She's got her mother, her maternal grandmother, her maternal great-grandmother, and so on to her maternal four great-grandmothers. So she's got she's gone very, very far on her female line. The thing to observe about this, though, is even if you are able to trace your male line and your female line, you have a lot of other ancestors. Look at all those other ancestors who are on neither the male line nor the female line. And you are what you are because of all of these people, not just the male line and the female line. So that, you know, puts it in perspective. And I mentioned there's an admixture test. The admixture test does look at the sum total of all the ancestry that you have. So that's a useful test. So what I want to talk about just a little bit is how you do this with a DNA test, because this is with a family tree. If you've got the family tree, you're all set. But if you don't have the family tree that goes back that far, then you need the DNA test. So how do you track the male line and the female line with a DNA test? Well, let's take a look at chromosomes. The human species, we're part of, we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. And two of those, the ones in the lower right-hand corner labeled X and Y, that pair of chromosomes are the ones that determine gender. So if you have an X and a Y, like the one up there, you're a male. You have a Y chromosome, you're a male. And females have XX, one X from the mother and one X from the father. In this case, the X of the male comes from the mother and the Y comes from the father. The Y is the same Y that his father has. It's the same Y that his grandfather, his paternal grandfather has. It's the same Y that his paternal great-grandfather has, and so on. And so that's what makes the Y chromosome so interesting. You only, all the way through history, it only gets given to male children from, you know, the male ancestor. So you can trace your male line by having an analysis done of the Y chromosome. So how do you trace the female line, though? That's a good question. So the female line uses something called the mitochondria. In the cell, in every one of your cells, not only is there a nucleus which holds the DNA that I just showed you, but also there are small objects called mitochondria, and they are the energy centers of the cell. They are what you need them for life, and they generate the energy to enable the cell to function. And the interesting thing is the mitochondria are only inherited from your mother. Whether you're male or female, your mitochondria only come from your mother. The egg cell. Has mitochondria. The sperm cell does not contribute any mitochondria from your father to the fertilized egg. So that then is used. They analyze the genetic material in the mitochondria to track the female line. It's quite interesting, I thought. So let me get back to Oprah for a minute here. I think people are kind of interested in Oprah. Oprah always thought she was a Zulu. I don't know why. I think people told her she looked like a Zulu, or she met Zulus and she kind of resonated with them. She thought she was a Zulu. So here along came Henry Louis Gates Jr. from Harvard and said, "I'm doing this study. Would you be one of the participants?" She said yes. And of course, there were two problems with Oprah's thinking she was a Zulu. First of all, I'm just finishing. Oprah, there were no Zulus in the slave trade. That was one problem. The slave trade took place in sub-Saharan Africa, but it went down as far as Angola. It did not go down as far as South Africa. And the Zulus live in South Africa. So that was one problem. The other problem is when they traced her female line, they found that she had a link to the Kapela tribe in Liberia, at least on the female line. So she'll probably now have to go up to Liberia and build another school, I would guess. And actor, just to give you a couple of other results they got, actor Chris Tucker's Y chromosome test, the male line, linked him to the Mbundu tribe of central Angola. And he went there and they gave him a tremendous reception. And Henry Louis Gates Jr. himself found, he did the admixture test, and he found that he was 50% European and 50% sub-Saharan African and 0% American Indian, which he thought definitely had some American Indian ancestry. So anyway, you can get surprised by these DNA results. That's it. That's all I've got.
Thank you very much, Neil. We'll take any questions for either Karen or Neil. Our comments, Marty?
How do you get the DNA samples from several generations back? In fact, how do they even find where they're buried? That must be very hard to do.
What they've done is they don't do that. But what they've done is they have a database. They are generating a database. Even today, they're adding to it. They go to Africa, for example, and they get samples from tribal members. They try to get pure stock, people who haven't, mixed, intermarried with other tribes or what have you. So they try to get, good data on each tribe. They also go to Eskimo groups, indigenous groups, American Indian groups, and so forth. So they have a growing database. So then when they compare your results, they're not comparing them with your ancestors. I wish they could, but they're comparing them with the database. And they told, for example, they told Oprah, your results look a lot like the results we have in our database for the Kapela tribe in Liberia. So that's as good as it gets, I think, right now.
A few years ago, there was a program on PBS about a black tribe in Africa that claimed to have always been Jewish. And finally, they put it to the test with DNA, and it was found that they were indeed related to the priests of the ancient tribe of Israel. And my question was pretty much the same: how does a white person get all these records apart from Ellis Island and the Mormons?
Yes, anybody can do a DNA test, and it's a simple thing, by the way. You just have a swab, and you put the swab on the inside of your cheeks, in your mouth, and just saliva, basically, and any cells that from your cheek that wind up on that swab. That's all they need. So it's not painful or anything. And I have a list of some of the labs that will do DNA testing. And anybody might find out something interesting. You don't have to be African American from those tests. There are databases that are in their proprietary you know, some of these labs are commercial, so they won't release their data. Others are doing research studies, but I list both kinds in my website, and they will tell you what percent, you know, you can do an admixture test, for example.
My name is Al Schwartz, and in 1976, I had the privilege of talking with Alex Haley. And it was brief, but memorable. I was a younger man, then, and I became absolutely taken with the book. I was taken with the not so much the Black history aspect, which you emphasized so well, but the roots. And I worked with a young lady who was similarly taken with the rootedness aspect of the book. We each went back three and on a couple of lines, four generations of Rochester roots. I came out of white Rochester. She came out of black Rochester. We formed a unique friendship that was probably less than 10 years from Rochester's worst moment in racial relationship, which was the riots down on Joseph Avenue in 1964. We became friends in the late 60s. We became taken with the book, and in late November of 1976, Alex Haley came to Rochester. And we went to see him. And he came to Sibley's. Where else would somebody come? Sibley's is no longer. It was Kaufman's, and now Kaufman's is no longer, and it's Macy's. But we went to the book signing, and it was most interesting. Both of us had been to previous book signings where the author just scribbles their name on the book. But Alex Haley talked to us, both of us, one white, one black, and found out a little bit about us. And he signed my book because he found that we both had a period where we had Ithaca roots. He was in Ithaca and I was in Ithaca. We missed by 2 years of each other. To Al Schwartz, sharing Ithaca roots. The man was dynamite. He was doing this, of course, in November, because in January came what Karen stated, and I felt so deeply, the TV show. 8 successive nights, 3 hours a night. We dropped everything for the TV show. The stars in it, Ed Asner, LeVar Burton, Chuck Connors, the rifleman, who played for the Rochester Royals basketball team, played first base at the old Red Wing Stadium for the Montreal Royals, Sandy Duncan, Lou Gossett Jr., Burl Ives, Robert Reed from the Brady Bunch, Vic Murrow, a young Cicely Tyson, a young Leslie Uggams, the dancer Ben Vereen, and a football player who crossed racial lines with his fame, having just broken the all-time rushing record, O.J. Simpson. Alex Haley wrote this article for TV Guide touting the series. I saved the article. Thanks to Neil and Karen, Ben Vereen would be proud of them keeping on the legacy. Alex Haley writes, "Finding Your Roots." This is how he concluded his TV. He not only wrote for Playboy, but he wrote for TV Guide as well. I mean, we don't have things like this anymore. Americans, particularly young people, seem afflicted with a sense of rootlessness. But this can be diminished if families will do 3 simple things. Query family elders for their memories of earlier family history. Write them all down. That's the words that were written down, saved. Send copies to each family unit. Locate and preserve those old trunks and boxes in attics. I read this to my grandkids. They said, "What's an attic?" In attics and closets. Usually they contain family history, items, and other memorabilia that are both precious and irreplaceable. And number 3, interesting. Here comes the third one, final one. Hold annual reunions It is particularly important to quietly influence younger people to reflect and contribute to their family's demonstrated pride in itself. Signed, Alex Haley. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. That was very interesting. Thank you very much. We'll take one last question.
I have one question, is that if Kunta Kinte came to this reading today, how would he view our work and our progress in relations with African Americans today?
Thank you. Everybody heard the question. Clearly, the question was, if Kunta Kinte was alive today, how would he view the progress that we have made as a society? There is no question in my mind that we have come a very far way. I mean, we have this Gen 6 thing going on. We have Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and many, many people gathering to protest. You can't help but conjure up and rethink about the 1950s, the 1960s, the freedom marches, the sit-ins, the church-ins, the swim-ins, the sit-ins at coffee shops. We've come so far with this need to come together to have these massive protests is so much limited. And we have so many laws that I tried to enumerate that have recognized that we did have problems as a society and tried to address them and ameliorate them. The DNA is fascinating. You know, there's this program called the Innocence Project. There were, prior to DNA, many folks who were convicted of crimes, largely people of color, who always maintained their innocence. There was no DNA. Now, with the advent of DNA, those cases are going back, being re-examined. DNA testing is being done. So far, there's about 165 people who have been exonerated. It's another statement of where we were as a society and where we are today, that there were, we did have a legal system, which is the institution I know best, that unfortunately had lots of bias and prejudice in it, from the law enforcement people to the police, the sheriffs, the prosecutors, the judges. Those folks are, for the most part, no longer in power. Juries who were quick to convict in the past, too quick, according to what we are learning from this DNA testing in the Innocence Project. We see that less and less today. So is it a perfect world for somebody in Kunta Kinte's view? I would think no, but have we made major strides? Are we a much better society? And are we continuing to try, which is a major statement about our society? And for all of those, you have to say yes.
Come up here a minute. Thank you very much. We really appreciate this, and we'd like to present you with an honorary membership in the Friends.
Oh,
nice certificate.
Thank you.
And our brand new Friends of the Brighton Memorial Library bags, which will shortly be on sale. And there's a little secret pocket in there for your library card.
Thank you. We really enjoyed it very much.
And one more minute, Sandra Frankel would like to say something.
Thank you. I am just thrilled to see all of you here this evening to celebrate this very significant event. The Friends of the Library, our Brighton Memorial Library, is a very special place. It's a place that reflects the values of Brighton, education, lifelong learning. So I want to thank the Friends and all of those associated with the library and all of the patrons who helped to make this such an important part of our community.
Please join us for refreshments in the rear of the... And thank you for coming.